Birth, Chapter 26. "We are on stealth approach," said the army pilot of General Cabarrus's helicopter. "Major, radio silence. Got it?" barked the general. "Yes, sir," said Major Canfield. He sometimes felt like a junior lieutenant, the way the general ordered him around. He was a commanding officer from Fort Bragg when the expansion happened at a cost of more than $180 million. North Carolina loved it, but the sequester debacle crippled the military structure during the Obama administration. Cabarrus and 15 other generals were relocated from the Pentagon to Fort Bragg. Canfield was transferred to staff duty during the merger. Like a giant corporation, many seasoned professionals were fired or transferred to streamline the operation and reduce costs. The result was a loss in command flexibility. Everything became micromanaged. There was a fever of competition as generals lusted after one more star. Cabarrus ended up on the Joint Chiefs because he was the last man to step back. No one wanted the job with Obama. His disdain for the military was expressed on a weekly basis as he refused to attend meetings. He would send his staff to listen and take notes, and then he asked for briefings to be sent to his tablet in bullet points. 21 generals took early retirement rather than sit in that circle jerk of a meeting week after week. Cabarrus took the job, thinking it would give him one more star. The sad commentary was that it did. His gruff and opinionated manner was annoying, but for some reason, he was favored in nearly every respect. Someone up there really liked him. Major Canfield was a good soldier and wanted to make colonel more than anything. He was promised that rank for his loyalty. He was not alone. The president's pressure on the military created an atmosphere of lust for power through favors and bribery. Most admirals and generals fought the sequester and Obama's targeting of the American people while supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. They resented Muslims with ties to terrorist groups serving in the administration. Some of them spoke out and were summarily fired with severe gag order penalties placed upon them. No books, no public statements. Hundreds of captains and colonels also retired early, forfeiting their military careers rather than serve under such leadership. Canfield was tempted, but the chance to reach the rank of colonel brought with it an enormous raise in pay, and once he reached that rank, he could not be riffed. He could retire with 75% of his base pay for the rest of his life. So, while the others were jumping ship, Major James Canfield was being promoted. It felt good, but sometimes, like right now, it felt bad enough to jump out of this helicopter without a chute. "Major," shouted the general. He snapped out of his pensive state of mind. "Yes, sir." "You kick some ass with these troops when we land. I'm expecting results," he said, boring into him with those dark eyes. "Yes, sir." The general did not like talk about what you were going to do. "Results," he would say. But if you started talking about details, he would say, "I hear a lot of clucking, but I don't see any eggs." The helicopter swooped lower once it cleared the trees of Camp David near the eastern edge of the runway. With an eastern breeze, they knew the jet would land from the west, over 2 miles away. There was no line of sight visibility to the staging point just inside the trees. The major jumped up as the Black Hawk landed firmly and shut off its engines. He slid the door open and hopped to the ground, putting on his helmet. He walked briskly over the two open troop carriers and heard the sergeant yell, "Attention!" There were two Humvees with gun emplacements on the roof. This was a good brigade, although there were no Rangers in the group. These were hand-picked warfighters with close combat experience. They looked like mercenaries to him. They had short beards, tattoos, and did not wear the uniform correctly, he thought. They were picked because they would take orders. Any orders. He stared at the men one by one. loosely in line, each one holding his weapon on a tether up close to their chest, with their right hand wrapped around the grip and the index finger extended over the trigger guard. Well trained, he thought. The general approached from behind and to the right. He did not speak, which was rare for him. Instead, he turned and walked toward the first Humvee, opened the passenger front door, and climbed in, slamming the door. The major could tell he was looking through the bulletproof glass at him, watching his style. At ease, he said. The men shifted their stance to something less than attention. Military bearing was not their strong suit. In a few minutes, a jet will land at the other end of this runway. There's a small group of insurgents on board with stolen classified information they mean to expose. We are not going to let that happen. Sir, no, sir, they said with a shout that surprised him. They didn't look the part, he thought, but these 16 men have fought as a unit before. There is a man with them who resembles the president. Do not be fooled. This man is an impostor and has a mission to seize control of the Site R Communication Center. We will stop him from achieving that mission. Am I clear? Sir, yes, sir, they recited. When that jet touches down, and not before, we will contact and destroy it on the runway. No survivors. Everything burns. Acknowledge, he spat. Sir, yes, sir. Radio silence. We let the Humvees lead, and the troop carriers flank either side when the plane is stopped. Sir, we have chatter. They have clearance to land. They are wheels down, said the pilot as he emerged from the helicopter. You stay here, and in the chopper, pointed Canfield. Let's load up. Wait for my lead in the other Humvee. He opened the passenger front door and slid inside, closing the 100-pound door behind him. The sergeant major barked his orders. You heard him. Load up and secure for engagement. 7 men piled into each of the 2 troop carriers and pulled the ramp door closed. The other 2 men climbed aboard the Humvees and assumed positions behind the swivel gun emplacements. The turbocharged 5.9-liter Cummins diesel motors growled to an idle with a puff of black smoke out the vertical exhaust stacks. The 2 Humvees had exactly the same motor, with the VP-44 fuel injection pump system. These motors had incredible torque, capable of towing just about anything, but they had one excellent feature that high-performance enthusiasts valued. They had a small electronic control board that could be externally programmed. There it is, said Major Canfield to his driver. On my command, let's head up the runway. He waited for the plane to disappear behind the rise of the runway. Okay, let's go. The Humvee surged forward as the turbo spun up. The gearing produced a top speed of only 70 miles an hour, but the troop carriers could barely do more than 55. The carriers split up, with one taking the far right side of the runway, while the other hugging the far left. The Humvees stayed side by side and took the center of the runway. In just about 1 minute, they would have the plane in sight. The major looked out his side window at the other vehicle. The general was staring straight ahead. It was in the hands of Major James Canfield now. It was his command. He could feel his moment approaching. He rolled down his window so he could feel the wind in his face. He felt exhilarated. He had been sitting at a desk for 10 years, filling out supply chain and administrative paperwork. Every I was dotted and every T was crossed. One by one, the other captains had been attrited. He chuckled quietly. That word, coined by General Norman Schwarzkopf during the First Gulf War. His television briefings to the American people were like high-stakes sports programs where enemies were attrited instead of blown away or killed by precision smart bombs. He was the last captain, and he was promoted to the rank of major. Soon, very soon now, he would be promoted again. Corporal, I think we need to go faster, said the major, realizing that they were slowing down. I can see the jet now, driver. We need to go left. Let's go, shouted the major. I've got it floored, Major, whined the young driver. I'm turning. I think we're all stalling out, Major. Sure enough, the major looked to the right, and the general could be seen pounding the dashboard. He was sure there was a similar conversation going on over there. He looked to the left, where a troop carrier should be flanking the white jet that had suddenly braked and turned completely off the runway into the dirt. That truck was also as slow as they were going. Are we all out of gas? He shouted at the corporal. No, sir. We have half a tank. The throttle is not responding. We are at an idle, shouted the corporal. Gunner, do you have a target? The major yelled back at the mercenary, gripping the 50-caliber machine gun. They're a mile away, sir. But I can maybe hit the jet or those vans over there, responded the gunner. The other vehicles are waiting for my signal. Fire a burst. Shoot them, he yelled. The gunner squeezed the hand triggers and the gun chugged a dozen rounds shot in the direction of the jet, now shrouded in a cloud of red dust from something. Within seconds, a short burst of 30-caliber rounds came back toward them. One round went neatly through the skull of Major James Canfield and broke the femur of the gunner. The driver, his face splattered with the major's blood and bone fragments, stopped the Humvee in the middle of the runway. He punched his seatbelt and opened his door, exiting the vehicle onto the runway. He vomited while wiping the blood out of his eyes. No more shots were fired. There was a new commander now. The general ordered his Humvee to stop as well. He opened his door and stood up on the door sill while holding onto the grip handle in the doorway. He raised his other hand and pointed his finger up. He waved it in a circle. The troop carriers stopped as well, and the rear doors opened. The soldiers poured out and began running toward the general's Humvee. As they arrived, they were clearly out of breath. It was nearly a 100-yard dash for all of them. They're escaping through the woods on the trail roads. There is an access door to Site R back there somewhere, he said, pointing to the north of the runway. They have about 3 miles to drive. We are about a mile south of that access door. You two, he said, pointing to the two youngest and tallest of the soldiers, get to the chopper back there and tell them to come and get us. No radios, got it? Yes, sir, they both said as they instantly began sprinting back the way they had come. The UH-60 Black Hawk can carry 20 lightly equipped troops. They had 19 left with the unfortunate demise of Major Canfield. Light arms would be all that is needed in the close quarters of the stone hallways inside Raven Mountain. The two runners arrived at the helicopter, still running as fast as they could. It reminded them of combat training. The co-pilot met the approaching soldiers in the open side door. Just you two? Asked the co-pilot. Sir, the general would like you to relocate to pick them up. We are 12 o'clock on the runway, about a half mile out, said one of the troops. Welcome aboard, said the co-pilot, stepping back into the cockpit. The door stayed open as the pilot began spooling up the twin General Electric T-700 GE-401C turboshaft engines. Within less than a minute, they were lifting off and tilting toward the general's position. It took slightly more than a minute to travel the half mile, because they had to accelerate, climb out, and negotiate the landing on concrete. 17 more troops entered the helicopter in remarkably good order and sat on the floor close together. Take us to the A access portal of Site R, yelled the general. Yes, sir, said the co-pilot. Hold on, we're heavy. The Black Hawk spooled up loudly and lifted slowly off the ground. It leaned slightly and went forward, still well within the rated payload. Within seconds, they were traveling 100 miles an hour and headed for the parking area near the access door. Raven Mountain had been connected to Camp David with a tunnel that was 6.2 miles long. Camp David is 90% wooded, with a few clearings and erosion control areas. Beneath the forest floor is almost solid green granite for more than 2,000 feet, making the area nearly impervious to attack. Within 3 minutes, the co-pilot turned around to face the general. Sir, we will land on the helipad across the street. Without radio contact, I do not know if the access door is open or even manned. You let me worry about that, said the general. The Black Hawk sunk to a landing on the helipad at Site R, and the doors slid open. The troops and their commander exited quickly. Lock and load, troops, shouted the general over the din of the twin engines. Sergeant Major, take 8 soldiers into access door A across the street from here, he growled. It goes back in about 100 yards and connects to access door B. Position yourself in the main hallway, and you can cover both entrances. You see something, kill it, and call me on secure channel 2, he said, handing him a radio. He twirled his hand over his head and hopped back into the helicopter with the 7 remaining soldiers to leave the area. It spooled up and lifted off. Take us to access door C, yelled the general to the pilot. Within seconds, the Black Hawk lifted off and headed east toward access door C. The facility is built like a giant right triangle, with a pair of access doors at each base of the shape. Along one of the legs was the air and water processing station. Along the other was a complex of 6 buildings built into the ground down to 950 feet in the green granite. They were flying across the densely wooded mountain, along what would have been the hypotenuse of the triangular structure. They were low across the trees to keep their noise to a minimum. When they touched down at access door C, they opened the doors and jumped out onto the paved area. The general twirled his finger again, and the helicopter spooled up and within seconds had disappeared over the trees, headed back for the airstrip. Let's go. We will stop them from entering the complex by holding this access hallways. No prisoners, he said flatly.